Welcome to The Attitude. This is Lincoln Mitchell filling in for Arnie Arneson. Arnie is out on assignment. I want to thank our producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a frequent guest on the show, although usually on the Rethink the Week. Occasionally, I guest host when Arnie has to go out on assignment. If you want more from me, I teach political science, international politics at Columbia University. And if you want to hear more from me, you can subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. We have a show today I'm really happy about. I have two guests on that I've been trying to get for a while to talk about topics that are very important for all of us and that I've been very interested in for a long time. Our first guest is Alex Cooley. And Alex is a professor of political science and vice provost for research, libraries, and academic centers at Barnard College at Columbia University. From 2015 to 2021, he served as the director of Columbia University's Harriman Institute for the Study of Russia, Eurasia, and Eastern Europe. And I wanted Alex on the show today because of what he's researching now, which is he's conducting research on the global illiberal backlash against Western global governance, liberal actors, norms, and institutions. And we talk a lot on this show about the crisis of democracy here in the United States, but I'm really hoping Alex can help us put that in a more global context and maybe get us thinking that it might be worse than we think it is. So Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Lincoln. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So let's start with maybe the big picture. How grave is the threat to democracy here in the United States? Are people like me who are saying this is very precarious? You know, this MAGA fascist regime could grab power, and that could be an enormous setback for American democracy. Are we overstating the threat? Are we understating the threat? What are your thoughts?
So the way I look at it is what we have now is a contestation over liberal democratic principles, right? An active contest going on. And that contest is happening at all levels of governance, right? Local, school board, statewide, federal, regional, global. And part of that contest is about institutional parameters, right? Institutional conventions and norms. And how far we can push those. So I'm not avoiding your question, but I think before we make a determination whether democracy is in peril or not, we have to understand that we are in a new phase where rules of the road that we thought were the democratic blueprint are now themselves subject to contestation back and forth. And so in some areas, we're going to see changes. In other areas, sort of, you know, the democratic framework is going to remain resilient. But that echoes what we're seeing in the rest of the world.
And maybe I could follow up because you raised two, to me, very important points. One is this notion of contestation, and one is institutions and norms. So, you know, those of us who grew up in the United States and we learned civics or our first political science course in high school, college, we're taught that the Constitution creates these institutions and these structures, which are essentially guarantors against tyranny. And then as we get into the last, you know, the kind of Trump era, if you will, seems to me what we're seeing is it really matters who's in these institutions. So, and the question that raises for me is that if it matters who's in the institutions, then institutions don't matter. Because institutions, the theory is, you know, Madison, go back to Federalist Paper 10, right? Madison saying that there's going to be people with bad intentions and we just have to manage that. But maybe the institutions can't do that. And the second point is contestation, because I couldn't agree with you more. And the point about contestation is both that there are these threats, but also that the threats don't go away. So as we're heading into 2024, just like in 2020, you know, 2020, when Biden won, people celebrated democracy had won. But if democracy is on the ballot every year, then it's not a consolidated democracy.
Yeah, so I think a couple of shifts have happened, especially over the last 10 years. It used to be in consolidated democracies, the U.S. included, that there was a relatively uniform understanding that party politics was about appealing to a median voter, right? And here in the context of a two-party system in Western European countries, you know, picking parties that would then form broad governing coalitions, right? So you could still have your party, you know, on the environment or on labor or your issue, but you would also understand they'd be one of a coalition conglomerate of parties. I think what's happened is that we have now shifted away, and incidentally, during the second Bush administration, we saw this sort of play out with Karl Rove's emphasis on creating a Republican governing majority, right? This idea of reaching out to Latino voters, especially on social issues, right? Sort of ensuring that there was enough of an appeal on the issues, right? And a framing of the issues in a favorable way to keep this Republican majority locked in. The difference now here, but also comparatively, is that this is no longer, the contestation is no longer over the policy preferences of the median voter. It's over the terms of the institutions themselves, right? So that involves things like gerrymandering. It involves things like passing restrictive legislations in states over who can and who can't vote. It is about rewiring legal proceedings to deal with things like immigration and asylum. And it's also about redefining institutional roles because of professional preferences, right? So, for instance, the independence of a central bank or the Fed, right? Or the autonomy of the civil service. These things that we took for granted are now on the table. And you're right, institutions themselves are just there. I mean, they used to be on paper, now they're there electronically. What they do is they assume good faith. They assume that they're going to be utilized in the way that they were drafted, as opposed to manipulated and made to do things that, initially they weren't meant to do. So I would say this is the phase that we're in, where we've gone from an emphasis on the voter to seeing how we can engineer this institutional framework. So then, yes, democracy does become on the ballot. And I agree with you that this is not a marker of democratic consolidation.
And one of the ways we really see this at this moment is Trump's effort to take his immunity claims to the Supreme Court, because the notion that the president has immunity to do absolutely anything dramatically changes institutional arrangements in American politics. It also is dramatically against both the letter and spirit of everything we know about American democracy. So one way to think about this perhaps is that, democracy or any regime type suggests the rules of the game. We're going to have elections. There's going to be a Congress. Legislature can do this. The executive can do that. Judicial that, et cetera, depending on the country. And now our politics are about what game are we going to play? Are we going to play baseball or are we going to play cricket? Are we going to play rounders, or are we just going to hit each other over the head with pool cues? But I want to ask you another question a little bit. You've alluded to this as some kind of, in a comparative context, which we don't get a lot in our frequently myopic discussions of American politics. I'm wondering, how do you think your comparative perspective helps you understand what's going on here better? And how can it help our listeners understand what's going on in the United States better?
I would say on two dimensions. One, we've already gotten into this idea that institutions can be repurposed, right? And so what we see across places that we thought were democracies, places in Central Europe, for instance, and Hungary is the big example here, led by Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who's now become a kind of a role model for many on the right here. What we've seen is Orban's really concerted effort to gain control of the media, right? To take control there, to eliminate institutional protections for educators, for the civil service, for financial governance oversight, right? And to then pass a series of restrictions on migrants and on higher education to sort of consolidate himself. So institutional tinkering, right, is sort of one part. But the second part, Lincoln, that we see all around the world is this appeal to illiberal norms, right? An agenda that is increasingly ethno-nationalist, that is also against immigration, that is pro-family, which means anti-LGBTQ, anti-feminism, and that also is taking away reproductive rights. These issues are framed increasingly as one of not being against the West, but redefining what the West is, right? Away from a liberal West to a much more sort of nationalistic, sovereign, conservative West. And so I think what we're seeing in the US is a realization that there are other transnational kind of movements in this and a networking between them, right? So, for instance, we see now Christian right organizations networking with counterparts in places like Moldova or Georgia, right? Or beforehand, Russia. So there's an awareness of the global position that they're in and that their fight against liberalism, they find common community in similar campaigns in places like Western Europe, as well as around the world in Africa and the Middle East and Asia as well.
So you've used this phrase transnational, and you've spoken about networks. This seems to me to be very important, right? So we see this on some level, the globalization of CPAC, right? CPAC has moved from being really a conservative conference to the kind of MAGA clown show, and now it's in Hungary, it's in all of these other places. So I would love to hear you flesh that out more, what this transnational networks really look like. For a long time, the United States thought of itself as helping to bring democracy to the rest of the world, right? And that was often honored in the breach, but there were some real success stories there. Today, at least one of our major parties seems to be an important node in this transnational fascist movement. And I'm wondering how much cross-fertilization is there really going on here? How much are people really talking to people? Do we have a sense of that?
So I think what the transnationalization has done, it has given these organizations a wider playing field. And in some ways, it's injected them with a global dimension that they didn't have before. I'll give you a couple examples. One is the NRA and its activities. While some may argue it's dying a slow death here, its transnationalization have given it new areas. So for example, in Brazil, right, the NRA was decisive in 2005 in the gun referendum there, right, where every major civic organization and political party supported a gun ban in response to the horrific violence that was happening there. The NRA's involvement in that referendum and framing things in terms of gun rights has not only tipped the balance of that referendum, it's created a new coalition in domestic Brazilian politics, affiliated also with Bolsonaro and Bolsonaro's son, right, who see this as the primary issue and link it to personal freedom the way it happens here. So it's changing the norms in places like Brazil. Second, we're actually getting international conferences and networks. So we used to think that international and transnational networks would get together to talk about things like human rights and the environment, right, and COP and so forth. Take the World Congress of Families. This was started by two Christian right organizations and increasingly became networked with similar kinds of pro-family groups across the world. Now they have annual conferences in places like in Hungary, in Moldova, in Georgia, in Verona, Italy, with plans also going to places like Brazil and Mexico. And there, what you see is a networking. A sort of exchange of tactics, of communication strategies, right? A kind of a real learning and appreciation for what they're doing. So this isn't just a question of sort of, Steve Bannon going over to a villa in Italy and having a training academy. What you're seeing scaffolded through the course of the year, sort of international gatherings and groupings where the common bond is thinking about how to undermine liberal in their respective liberalism in their respective home countries.
And what strikes me here is that the model can apply to such a range of countries, right? So here in the United States, the MAGA fascist movement is very much married to Christian nationalism. And the demographic support in the United States comes, for that movement, comes from people who are heavily but not exclusively white, tend to skew older, less educated, more rural, and more religious. That same demographic can exist in a country that is majority non-white, right? So, for example, Turkey, for example, so that you could take out the Christian piece of it, but belonging to the majority ethnic group, right? And then all of the other qualifiers. It seems as we discuss this, there's a node here, a very important node that we shouldn't overlook, which is Moscow and the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. And this is complicated, or this is important for a couple of reasons. One is he seems to be driving this a lot, particularly in that part of the world, in Eastern Europe, as well as the more further eastern parts of what had been the Soviet Union, but also because of a relationship between Putin and his government and the leadership of the Republican Party that could charitably be described as concerning and more realistically perhaps described in more stark terms. Where does Russia and Putin fit into this?
So it's a good question. And I would say that Putin himself has evolved on this, especially over the last 10 years, where we've seen a real dialing up of this sort of counter-liberal norm messaging. Putin has always opposed geopolitically Western encroachment in his, bordering neighboring countries. The war that he had with Georgia in 2008 that you know a lot about, Lincoln, and of course, 2014 in Ukraine. So he's always been concerned about Western encroachment, meaning both NATO and the European Union, and the expansion, right, of this Western transatlantic, liberal coalition. What you've seen, especially over the last 10 years, is an increasing dialing up of sort of stigmatizing liberal actors. So this started with making NGOs and civil society actors working on things like human rights having to identify as foreign agents, right, back in sort of 2012, that they weren't really Russian actors, they were sort of foreigners. Then 3 years later, he started just outright banning them, calling agents and then expanding this to journalists, individuals, undesirable, right? Criminalizing these kinds of associations and issues. And then what now you see is increasing public messaging that is not just about Russia, but really appealing to this, community of conservatives in Western Europe and the US in his public communications, talking about the failure of liberalism, the overexpansion of rights, the problem with cancel culture. A lot of Putin's communications seem actually tailored and signaling to a US audience. I'll give you and your listeners one example. And I teach this. This is in Putin's annexation speech of the four provinces in Ukraine that he gave in September 2022. In that speech, there's stuff about, history and Ukraine always being part of Russia and so forth. But then there's this like bizarre paragraph about the sort of evils of gender reassignment surgery, right? That we're no longer going to take this, right? We're no longer going to be sort of slaves to this idea and ideology. We're no longer going to be canceled. Well, the appeal to gender reassignment surgery is something that I would submit is there for an American audience, right? This isn't sort of a serious issue on the minds that's being debated, in Russian society. But I think Putin has realized that cumulatively, the messaging is creating constituencies for his kind of illiberal pushback and real sympathy for the cause.
And it seems that this is significant for a number of reasons, but one is that we are not used to Russian or before that Soviet leaders communicating directly with the American people. There was a time when Soviet leaders through the Communist Party of the United States communicated with a relatively small segment of the American people. But this is also a product of both a different technological era and a different phase of American power, right? A different stage of American power. Where in the immediate post-Cold War, we just kind of assumed we could say and do whatever we wanted in that part of the world. And there's no other side of that coin. But in fact, there is a very ugly, ugly other side of that coin. And you alluded to the annexation speech that Putin made several years ago now. But we also have to, there also is now this full-scale invasion, which began, 2 years ago this week, actually. 2 years ago from the day we'll be broadcasting this. And there, so there's a frame here in the United States that is, this is the battle for global democracy. Defending Ukraine is essential for the future of global democracy. I believe that defending Ukraine is essential for the future of Ukraine. And that's why I would support it. I do support it. But I'm wondering how we fit that into the real battle for democracy. It seems to me that the real battle for the future of American democracy is not occurring in Luhansk or somewhere like that. It's occurring in Arizona and Wisconsin and Georgia, the state of Georgia, not over there.
So I think what Putin has done very successfully in the course of the last 2 years, the Ukraine war, is make this about almost everything else except Ukraine, right? So initially you saw the messaging the first month was, what was the rationale of the quote-unquote special military operation? It was to denazify Ukraine. But, you know, for your listeners, actually the denazification thing wasn't super popular in Russia. Right? It wasn't really catching on, right? Oh, yes, all these Nazis running around in Ukraine. Very few people bought it. Instead, you see a public messaging 2 months into that this is about the global order. This is about US imperialism. This is about this laundry list, take your pick of post-Cold War grievances of dollar hegemony, of the US engaging in double, no triple standards. And so that has gotten him a lot more traction, right? That you inject into the Ukraine conflict that this is no about US imperialism. This is about trans people. This is about any other kind of issues that grafts onto Ukraine. I think successfully, he's created that dynamic here, right? Where Ukraine has now become not about a country being invaded, but, you know, on the right, Ukraine is about entrapping the foreign presidents, conspiring, corrupting his son, right? Creating these sorts of
Corrupting
rabbit
Biden's
holes.
son, to be clear.
That's right. That's right.
The Biden family
Corrupting
corruption.
Biden's son. And I think, you know, the victims on this are sort of like Ukrainian people and citizens who are just, I think, staring in disbelief as all of these other fears, phobias, and politics get projected onto them. So this is where I think the Biden administration's messaging that this is about democracy is not helpful. This is about a country being invaded and it defending its sort of sovereignty and its territorial sovereignty. Because the minute you make this about democracy, other countries start projecting what that means to them and the issues that they might have with that, especially if it's the US judging.
Also, you suggest that if you're not a democracy, it's okay for Putin to invade you, which isn't really the case. You know, that's a heck of a position to take.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And Ukraine was, of course, central to the first impeachment of Donald Trump. It continued to be part of the 2020. I mean, there's a lot of things that went into the 2020 election here in the United States. But as we head into 2024, well, we are in 2024, as we head into this election, with all of this, I mean, obviously the future of Ukraine is very much at stake in the 2024 election here in the United States. No one understands that better than Putin, as far as I can see. There's a great deal at stake, both for Ukraine, but also globally for democracy. And there is nothing that would jumpstart this trend, as far as I can see, this transnational fascist movement, like the return of Donald Trump to the White House. Am I reading that right? Is that what's at stake here? It seems to me there's an awful lot, not just here, but globally.
It is a stake. And what we saw this is that Trump did not have a good sense of how the bureaucracy worked initially. He started to get a better sense his final years. But what you really saw Donald Trump's international foreign policy is going to look at through ambassadorial appointments, right? Appointing figures to Germany, Hungary, rest of European countries that were really on the MAGA wing and that did not believe in the transatlantic institutions that the State Department and the Department of Defense were trying to uphold. And so this is where you had a situation of the ambassador to Hungary openly allowing the Hungarian government to shut down a university that was the biggest investment in higher education in the world. This was a Central European University. So that's what you're going to get, people who are loyal and who believe in the kind of illiberal agenda.
And it is just as it's difficult to consolidate democracy, it's difficult to consolidate authoritarianism. Trump had a 4-year run, and if he gets a second 4-year run at it, he unfortunately will have a good chance of being more successful. Alex, this was a great discussion. I wish we had more time to go on. I really enjoyed this. Thanks for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure having you. This is again Lincoln Mitchell filling in for Arne Arnesen, who is out on assignment. We'll be right back after this short break.
Let's reflect for a minute on the recent remarks of Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan.
Listen up.
This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Justice Kagan, during a public conversation at the Library of Congress, avoided saying anything directly relevant to any case before the court. But she did articulate decision-making principles and powerfully shared her perspective on the court discarding precedent. Justice Kagan said, "When the law flip-flops after change in personnel on the court, it doesn't look like law anymore. It looks like a form of politics." She continued, "And I think that's especially important for this Supreme Court at this time. Law should not look like a form of politics, where just because the composition of the court changes, a whole batch of legal rules change with it." Justice Kagan added, "When what was once a right is no longer a right because the court is different, I think that's very damaging to the court, very damaging to society." Justice Kagan did not mention any one of the dozens of examples where this Supreme Court has reversed or dramatically changed longstanding law, but as Adam Liptak wrote in the New York Times, it was a good bet that the court's 2022 decision overruling Roe v. Wade was among one of the ones on her mind. And let us add, ours too.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union, because freedom...
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to The Attitude. This is Lincoln Mitchell filling in for Arnie Arneson, who is out on assignment. Our new guest is Gil Duran, and I'm very pleased to have Gil on the show today talking about an issue that's very important for me, but let me just tell you a little bit about who Gil is. Gil Duran is an independent journalist who writes the Frame Lab newsletter with Dr. George Lakoff and also publishes in the New Republic and the San Francisco Chronicle. Before returning to journalism, Gil served as a top advisor to California politicians, including Jerry Brown, Dianne Feinstein, and Kamala Harris. Gil Duran recently had an article in the New Republic. The date in that article is February 12th, of this year, so you should be able to find it. And I really wanted to bring him on to talk about that article and some of the ideas you raised there. That article is called "The Tech Plutocrats Dreaming of a Right-Wing San Francisco." So Gil, welcome to The Attitude.
Thanks for having me.
And just to get started, the tech plutocrats, who are these right-wing people in San Francisco? What's their background? Who are they? Where do they come from?
Well, the first thing I would tell people is to go to missionlocal.org and look up the project called Big Money SF, because that does a really great job of showing and visualizing who these people are and what they're trying to do. But in terms of the names of some of these people, you have a very recognizable name, Elon Musk, who has pledged to drop $100,000 into San Francisco politics this year, has yet to do so because he sometimes has trouble keeping his promises, but is using Twitter to really lift up right-wing voices and really toxify the political discourse. There's Gary Tan, who's the CEO of something called Y Combinator, a very well-known venture fund that trains new startups, and who was also the 10th employee at Peter Thiel's Palantir. And he seems to be spearheading this effort as a very vocal spokesman for this new kind of right-leaning politics in San Francisco, also pouring a lot of money into races like the Chase Boudin recall and various measures and efforts this year. David Sachs, a member of the PayPal Mafia with Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, who is also a pretty far-right Republican donor who, when he's not attacking California politics or progressives, is attacking Joe Biden and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky. There's Chris Larson, who is the founder of Ripple. He's a crypto billionaire who is now funding a network of private surveillance cameras all over San Francisco. Nothing big brothery about that. In the past, there's also been William Obendorf, a big Republican donor who bankrolled the Chase Boudin recall, and other people like Ron Conway, Emmett Shear, Michael Moritz, a billionaire who's now spending heavily in local politics and also has his own newspaper, The Standard, which actually does some pretty good reporting, at least in this phase of its existence, has some real journalists on staff. There are others as well, but there's a pretty good name. And I'd say go to missionlocal.org, look up Big Money SF, and you'll get the full picture.
I would also recommend the Phoenix Project, which is just starting, but is also tracking a lot of the right-wing money there online too. The Phoenix Project. Phoenix Project Now is the website. So much of the discourse around San Francisco, certainly nationally, is, you know, San Francisco is far left, and a conservative in San Francisco would be a liberal anywhere else. And we see that a lot in local politics too. One way we see this is the media constant referring to anyone on, you know, to the right of, I don't know, to the right of, I would say Aaron Peskin, who is the president of the board of supervisors, as a moderate. These people you described, they don't have resumes that scream moderate. They have resumes that scream more conservative. And I'm wondering, how does that framework bog down a real understanding or stop us from really understanding what's going on there? And secondly, besides their kind of right-wing bona fides, what is the right-wing agenda for the city of San Francisco?
Well, I think if you look at San Francisco politics, there is a sort of polarized local politics on the Democratic side. People who would be considered, as you said, progressive Democrats anywhere else are considered very conservative sometimes in San Francisco. And, you look at some of the Democrats who've come out of San Francisco. You've got Nancy Pelosi. You've got Gavin Newsom. You've got Kamala Harris. Dianne Feinstein, for whom I worked in the Senate back in the 2010s, was the mayor of San Francisco, and is looked back on as pretty moderate/conservative. I used to call her, behind her back, of course, the most popular Republican in California. But obviously, to the Fox News audience, she's a far left-wing Democrat. So there is some of this drift in terms of how we interpret it. But what I would say is that, I do a lot of work with George Lakoff. We have a newsletter called The Frame Lab, and we study ideology and moral politics. And what's important to do is to look at the actual solutions or policies they're pushing, because there's no such thing as a moderate ideology. There's no one group of things that all moderates agree on. To be moderate means that you have some things you're progressive on, perhaps, and some things you're conservative on. It's a mix. And so when you're looking at these this new crop of billionaires, mostly guys, who are coming in and trying to shift politics, you have to look at the policies individually and in total to understand what it is they're actually going for. And when you look at what they're pushing for, it's pretty clearly and indisputably a far-right Republican platform. They want the expansion of mass incarceration. They want a repeal of police reform and criminal justice reforms that have been hard won over decades. They want to return to the war on drugs, even though we know it doesn't work and will just hurt a lot of people. They want to abolish almost every form of harm reduction, which we know is a proven solution to save lives in the middle of a terrible and deadly drug overdose epidemic. And they want a massive increase in surveillance, including cameras that can kind of zero in and see your eye color. This is what's going on in San Francisco right now. And I have no doubt, because I go deep and read all the stuff they're reading and read the writers they're reading, that if they are to gain power, if they do gain power in San Francisco, this will expand, include a war on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trans rights, and will also deregulate as much as they can in the city any limits on their power so that they can do whatever they want and turn San Francisco into a laboratory for big tech and a place where it's basically illegal to be poor. So I think you really have to look at their policies to see why I call them right wing, why they should be called right wing. The moderate part is really missing from their policy platform. There's a way to have a moderate policy platform. This is clearly not it.
I was having a conversation with someone who attended an event, a right-wing event, where the mayor was there, London Breed. And one of these tech people asked her, can't we just abolish the Board of Supervisors? For those of you who don't know San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors is the city legislature. Abolishing a legislature is any sentence that begins with that doesn't end well for democracy, and in no way moderate. I want to touch on your point about Dianne Feinstein, because I lived in San Francisco the entire time she was mayor. I remember very well the day she became mayor, for obvious historical reasons. Anyone who was there that day remembers that. Feinstein was indeed, we viewed her as a conservative, as a mayor. But what she has that San Francisco thing where to the outside world, for several reasons, she was always going to be seen as liberal, right? She was a Jewish woman mayor in San Francisco. And in the context of the time, very strongly pro-LGBT, because you can't win for dog catcher in San Francisco if you're not pro-LGBT. I think that's great from a political perspective. It's a reality. And what strikes me is a lot of these people, and you touched upon this more eloquently in your article, they do have liberal positions on a handful of social issues. Being anti-gay, running a strong anti-gay platform the way you might in Oklahoma, is not going to work in San Francisco. But that doesn't make you a moderate. It's just one policy position, perhaps with a whole bunch of others that are much more conservative. But a question I want to ask you is, how are they trying to do this? You've outlined an agenda for San Francisco. I know that city pretty well. I don't think that's going to be wildly popular there. How are they trying to get from here to there?
Well, one thing they're trying to do is take over the Board of Supervisors in the 2024 elections. They've got a slate of candidates running who are clearly sort of handpicked puppet candidates who will do their bidding once they're on the board. They sort of kind of came out of nowhere and are now running with lots of money behind them against often against incumbents who have been there, placed there by the voters and who have long histories in city politics. There are also some open offices they're running for. They see opportunities there. That's the real question, I think, is whether they can win in district elections, because, as you know, the districts here tend to vote pretty progressive and have done so in recent years. So it's, you know, the idea that these folks push is that somehow progressive politics destroyed San Francisco. But when you look at the history of San Francisco, it's pretty moderate politics with a lot of emphasis on more Republican policies toward things like crime. I did a story when I was at the Examiner about how basically for the past 70 years, mayors and politicians and DAs have been promising to crack down on the crime in the Tenderloin, and they're still doing it. It hasn't worked. So there's always something new to crack down on. The other thing they're trying to do, there are ballot propositions on the ballot this year. And that's where you get the repeal of police reform. They're trying to do a ballot proposition that would force, would require the city to drug test people asking for any kind of public assistance. Very Republican, Reagan-style policy there. And they're trying to strip power from the Board of Supervisors through a ballot measure and give it more to the mayor, because they think, you know, London Breed has been able to convince them that the big problem is she doesn't have enough power. Although she's simultaneously engaging in these multiple crackdowns on crime with the power she claims to not have. So there's a real built-in confusion here over whether she does or does not have the power to be the mayor of San Francisco. I would argue that she does. The other ways they're trying to affect it, they're flooding a lot of money in. I think they've created a lot of polarization around these issues. You've got this whole right-wing media component where Fox News and the Daily Mail and the Epoch Times and all of these propaganda outlets are constantly focused on the problems of San Francisco, lifting them up to a national audience and really sort of putting a lot of pressure on national Democrats also to condemn San Francisco or be responsible for it. So you've got a full-on, fully integrated, big money propaganda effort with local political tentacles as well, aiming to seize power as much as possible in 2024.
And stop me if I'm wrong or if you want to flesh this out, but they're doing it not through, because San Francisco has pretty strict and good campaign finance policy and campaign finance law. So they're doing it through these organizations, which, you know, Grow SF, Neighbors for a Better San Francisco, Together SF, which, and this is significant. One, it's a workaround, right? It's a way to funnel enormous amounts of money and to get around the campaign finance laws, which are meant to give people with community ties, but not ties to real money. I would just think of in District 1, Connie Chan, the incumbent, is an example of somebody who has benefited from the campaign finance law by playing it by the book, because that's where her background. She doesn't come from money. She doesn't have access to that kind of funds, but she's a good politician and is able to raise enough money to win an election. But they're trying to work around that through these organizations. But what's important to me is these organizations, there's a disingenuousness to them, because they speak the language of common sense solutions, a word that phrase that has no meaning in reality. They speak the language of, we're just trying to solve problems, common sense. Everybody wants a better San Francisco. How are they? I mean, first of all, is that the right way to understand what the tactical approach is? And how important are these organizations?
Well, it's a way they can get a lot of money into politics and really kind of get their ideas out there and organize people and make them full-time organizers or spokespeople for these ideas. And I think you zeroed in on common sense. That's a pretty good indicator. I think common sense in this sense is very Orwellian. Like moderate, there's no one meaning of common sense. And
sense means whatever the speaker wants, right?
Yeah. Well, common sense should mean that things that are proven to work and that have shown results, right? This is one of the reasons I consider them not only right wing, but pretty extreme. Everything they're pushing for is stuff we already tried and that already failed and that will fail again. That's pretty extreme. These are the guys who are supposed to be leading us into a beautiful and abundant tech future, you know, where we're not going to have to work and we're all going to be, you know, time billionaires and we're all going to have, you know, AI as our doctor curing all of our diseases. And all they have to offer is plutocracy and prisons and retrograde punishment for the poor, and to oppose overdose prevention, which we know would save lives in a city where 806 people died of overdoses last year, is very, very harshly retrograde. It's the opposite of common sense. It's evil, to be honest. It's deeply immoral to oppose something that we know could save lives and that has worked in other places. So when they say common sense, they mean it in a very Orwellian way. Common sense is whatever they say it is. And it's usually the opposite of any kind of sensibility or logic or reason.
And one of the areas that they really hammer on common sense is crime, right? So this was the recall of Chesa Boudin. And to me, there was a lot of significance to that recall, one of which was Chesa has a very unusual personal story, right? His parents were members of the Weather Underground. I can't think of another elected official in the United States with that story. But his policies were in the mainstream of urban district attorneys. But what happened was these groups told a story about crime in San Francisco that, now I'm older. I remember when I go back to San Francisco and I'd spent a lot of time there, I'm always struck by how safe it was. Neighborhoods that I felt unsafe walking around in middle school and high school are now completely safe. There's the murder rate, the homicide rate is half of what it was when I was growing up in a city that's significantly higher population. But they've told a story about crime that, to me, that's the linchpin here. And that's where a lot of these propagandists have told that story more. So how do we kind of get away from that? I mean, this seems like a blindness that because they've won the narrative on this.
Well, a lot of it is based on, you know, the well-known fallacy or propaganda technique of anecdotal fallacy. Oh my God, there's this crime that took place. It's on video. It's viral. That means crime is worse than ever. Now, that's contrary to the data and the statistics, which show that we're at pretty low crime levels in the state of California. And San Francisco has a relatively very low crime rate. And the top 10 cities for the highest crime rates in the nation are actually in Republican states with harsh draconian policies. So if those kind of policies work, why is crime higher in Republican states than it is in the blue state of California, where we had a major criminal justice reform that, surprise, surprise, has coincided with some of the lowest crime rates in decades? If Republicans did a reform and it resulted in lower crime, we'd never stop hearing about it. But instead, what we're hearing is that somehow criminal justice reform, which has lowered crime rates, is the root of all evils and is a big problem. And that's their next target for repeal, by the way. It's not going to end with the city of San Francisco. They want to take over California. I worked in politics for a long time. And sometimes people think that I was somehow born a progressive, but I was Jerry Brown's press secretary in the city of Oakland 20 years ago. And we were tough on crime. We did all the stuff they're talking about doing now. And we did it even better than London Breed is capable of doing it. We were full on hardcore. We had parolee curfews. We were doing all the bringing the CHP, which they do now, bringing the CHP as if that's something new. We were doing it 20 years ago. We did all those things. And, you know, there's still a lot of crime.
CHP is the California Highway Patrol for non-Californians. Go
on. Mayors do this thing where they bring, that's the governor to bring in the Highway Patrol and flood the streets with police. We did all of that. You can do that for a while. You can suppress crime with a big surge. But the thing is that that's never sustainable. It costs a lot of money. It's resources we don't really have. And so when I see these people talking about doing all the stuff we did 20 years ago, as if that's something that is new or going to work, it's very, very disheartening. And I think it's very disingenuous as well. So we, you know, we don't, it's not clear what the end game is here, except for more blame, right? They have their DA who took over from Chase Aboudin, Brooke Jenkins. A lot of what she says, you could put it on a quiz and ask who said it, Chase Aboudin or Brooke Jenkins, and it'd be hard to distinguish. She seems to have discovered all of the problems that Chase Aboudin said were in the way of prosecuting every case. You can't do every case. You have to take some plea deals because the courts get too clogged up. In fact, Jenkins just dismissed a bunch of cases because the backlog from COVID was too big. If Chase Aboudin had done that, it'd be a national story all over Fox News, and there'd be a recall campaign launched immediately. Brooke Jenkins does it, and everything's fine. That's the other thing I think it's important to point to when we talk about common sense or the Orwellian tactics. Suddenly, they've tried to change the narrative from San Francisco being in a doom loop to everything being okay now because they want Mayor Breed to win and because they've got Brooke Jenkins. But the problem is the polls show that people think the problems have actually gotten worse under Brooke Jenkins. And so we already have, in a very small example here, evidence that what they've done is not working, and yet they want to do more of it.
And it should be noted that at the moment, the two major candidates challenging London Breed are challenging her from the right, which is kind of extraordinary given that there's yet to be a progressive getting the race. There still is some time, maybe, but it's not a lot of time left. That election is coming in this November. I wanted to, a couple of points I want to touch on hopefully we have time for both of them. The first is this, and you raise this, I want you to flesh this out a little bit though. You talked about Oakland back when Jerry Brown was the mayor there. You spoke about how crime is actually worse in red states, right, where these right-wing policies have been implemented. So the question I'm would like you to talk about is, you know, San Francisco, okay, in my view, it's a great city. You know, it's got all these great things, including a football team that almost was great enough to win the Super Bowl, you know, a baseball team, all this stuff. Why is San Francisco important? Why is a right-wing effort to take over San Francisco? Why is that somebody that listeners around the country need to care about? Because I think they do.
Well, first of all, to your point, San Francisco is the safest city where I've ever lived, right? I've lived a lot of places in the country, and I felt safe in San Francisco. There are places where you can go and see horrible things happening, but generally you don't go there unless, you know, as a journalist, I'm trying to go see people on drugs and being very ill in the streets. And there are problems, too. There's no doubt about that. There's way too much homelessness these days. We shouldn't be a society where people have to live in tents and sleep in the cold and filth of the streets. But I think San Francisco is an important symbol because it's a democratic city in a democratic state. You have people like Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi, who all come from San Francisco. And so it's important for the right-wing forces nationally and even internationally, as we've seen, to show that the result of democratic governments is essentially Sodom and Gomorrah, and that only by right wing taking over the city can we fix its problems. It's a very simple narrative that ascribes direct blame to one party while claiming the other party, which is actually worse at these things, can fix it. And I think that's been the main game for a while. To some degree, I also worked for Jerry Brown when he was the governor. They were doing this to us when we had the big budget deficit back in 2009 to 2013. Oh, California's like Greece. California's going to fail. They always find a way to make California the story. But if you go and look at what's happening in Republican states with their high poverty rates, the highest overdose rates, by the way, in the country, all red states, they are not solving the opioid problem with their harsh policies. It's just an Orwellian counter narrative to cover up the failures of their own policies while focusing everyone's attention on what's happening in San Francisco. And there are some very places you can go where you can see people using drugs openly on the streets. And the difference is that when people OD in a place like Kentucky, where I spend a lot of time, where I have family, they typically do it in a motel room or in a trailer where you can't see them. They're not all congregated in the street. But, there's a lot of homelessness in San Francisco because people can't afford to live here. And I think the most important thing to keep in mind, and this is the thing that I think I most condemn these right-wing techies for, you have a city that probably has more billionaires than almost any city in the world, San Francisco. And it seems like the more billionaires we get, the more tents in the street we get, the more poverty and visible pain and suffering we get. And their only answer for solving those problems has nothing to do with addressing those underlying social issues that are producing these results in mass quantities. It's only to punish and cage the poor. And I think we have to push back on that while we still can. And I see way too many Democratic politicians who call themselves progressives, being really quiet or being really cozy with these guys. And there's only one reason for that. They've got money.
And to a great extent, the problems you've outlined, particularly around affordable housing, are problems caused by affluence, not poverty in San Francisco. You refer to how they want to describe San Francisco as kind of these blue cities and blue states as Sodom and Gomorrah. In the 1980s, Herb Kane, used to be the legendary San Francisco columnist who really forged the modern identity, particularly among San Franciscans of our city, described San Francisco as Sodom by the sea, and we thought that was a compliment. But we're kind of low on time, but we can't leave this conversation without talking about Gary Tan, who you alluded to, who, and you wrote this in your piece, this is a city where we take death threats on elected officials seriously. And he made death threats, die slow, and then he used a profanity, referring to seven elected officials. He mentioned one of them, Connie Chan, twice, I guess because of particular animus towards her. My question is, how come other than those elected officials, many of whom received death threats in the mail targeting them and their families, so few other people seem to care about it? Where was the outrage from London Breed, Brooke Jenkins, Scott Weiner, the local elected officials who weren't targeted? Is that just about they needed this money?
Pretty much, their silence speaks volumes, and they seem to think they can just sort of cozy up. If a progressive had said this, if Dean Preston had issued a threat, it would have had massive condemnation from all of these people. But I thought that was pretty interesting. The money has definitely bought their silence and made many of these sometimes brave politicians into cowards, and I think that's concerning. I think maybe they're trying to triangulate. The politics is pretty polarized. I mean, to be honest, if you're progressive but you veer from the left platform in any way in San Francisco, you're suddenly demonized as a conservative. The left doesn't give some of these politicians a lot of places to go. But I don't think that's an excuse to cozy up to people like Gary Tan. And Gary Tan has kind of, well, first of all, he's got a lot of people blocked on Twitter, so a lot of people may be unaware of his outlets. Apparently, he just blocks large swaths of the
Sure,
city.
he's blocked both of us.
Yeah, you have to have a burner account, an anonymous account, to cover San Francisco politics these days, because there's a lot of blocking going on, but a lot of discourse going on in these walled gardens where the billionaires are praised by their blue check sycophants every time they say something stupid. But Tam was raising his profile as this attack dog. I think the San Francisco Standard called him a pit bull on Twitter. But he turned out to be a more of a teacup chihuahua, because the moment he slid off the skids, he just had gone completely silent, not peeping up about anything. He learned the hard way that what every intern in a campaign knows: you do not get drunk and start making death threats on Twitter. That becomes an issue. It hurts your entire effort, and you're done.
Gil, we could talk about this all day. Thank you so much to Gil Durand, independent journalist, longtime political figure and writer in San Francisco. Please go back and read his article from February 12th in New Republic, The Tech Plutocrats Dreaming of a Right-Wing San Francisco. Again, this is Lincoln Mitchell from Columbia University, filling in for Arnie Arneson, who is out on assignment on The Attitude. I want to thank our producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You can find out more from me reading my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you, Gil. Thank you to our previous guest, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than 10.